So where the sabotaging behaviors come in is that we, like I said, we develop all of these traits when we, as coping mechanisms, okay? Because ultimately the surviving brain is only occupied with keeping you alive. It doesn't care if you're living your best life. It doesn't care if you're married, if you're having fun, if you're enjoying things, if you've got purpose. It just wants to keep you alive. And of course, it's fear-based messaging, yeah? It's all fear-driven. Because ultimately, our main fear as soon as we're born is that we're going to die.
One, two, three, four.
Welcome to the Emotional Intelligence Podcast, a podcast where we explore the intersection of emotional intelligence and leadership. And whether you're a seasoned executive or just starting out in your leadership journey, we're going to share practical tips, inspiring stories, and expert insights to help you develop your emotional intelligence and achieve your goals. So sit back, relax, and get ready to take your leadership skills to the next level. I'm Ismail.
And I'm Samir.
Today, we're excited to introduce Ani Naqvi, a transformative coach with quite a remarkable story. Ani is a survivor of the 2004 Asian tsunami, which turned her profound experience into a journey of purpose. This was leading her from a successful 15-year career as a C-suite executive and BBC journalist to becoming a full-time accredited coach. Ani's on a mission to empower 250,000 people by combining diverse disciplines like NLP, meditation, and mindfulness into coaching. We're really excited to have you, Ani, and thank you for taking the time to meet with us.
Of course. Thank you for having me on.
Before we launch into our topic, we're going to be talking about self-sabotage and saboteurs. I'd love just, you know, for you to take a moment to share a little bit about yourself. I covered a little bit about it, but curious your experiences and you know, how you actually came to get on to Oprah's show.
Sure. Thank you for that. So currently I work as an executive transformation expert or a consultant, coach, and mentor. And I work with high achieving leaders, CEOs, and C-suite level executives. The reason I got on to the Oprah Winfrey Show was because I was holidaying on the east coast of Sri Lanka in a little village called Aragon Bay, which was the second worst hit. East Coast was the second worst hit after Banda Aceh. And when I made it to higher ground and I started to understand the scale of the disaster with the amount of people that had been killed and things like that, I realized that given our proximity on the East Coast, that we would not get rescued straight away. So we were kind of stranded in the area that we were in. The fifth wave, we had seven waves in Aragon Bay. So it was, yeah, and it was the fifth wave that actually took out the bridge that connected the peninsula that we were staying on to the mainland. So, you know, I nearly got caught up in two of the first waves, but obviously didn't made it to higher ground before the others came along. So when I was on that hilltop, that higher ground that we'd gone to, as I said, you know, when we found out that the fifth wave took out the bridge, I kind of knew that, you know, we were stranded where we were. We were kind of surrounded by a crocodile-filled lagoon and a leopard-filled jungle and then the killer tsunami on one side. So we were kind of like trapped. And having been a former broadcast journalist for the BBC, I know how these things go, that it's when there are tourists in a certain place that you then get the news coverage and the rescuing and all that kind of thing. And given that, by then, I had figured out that the tsunami had gone Asia-wide because somebody had come along with a jeep at some point. So I was listening to the radio, and that's when they were saying that all of Asia had been affected, places like Thailand and India, Indonesia, obviously, as well. So I kind of just intuitively knew that I needed to get press coverage on our plight in order to get rescued. And so I don't know how, but I managed to remember the number of the BBC switchboard.
That's helpful. That is helpful. Good piece of information.
Exactly. And I contacted them and I got through to a journalist there and I explained our situation. And I said to them that they needed to get hold of the British High Commission on our behalf to get us rescued. And sure enough, the High Commissioner called me back on this guy who had the phone in the Jeep. He had a phone as well on his phone. And then I started to sort of organize the relief effort. It was already too late for that day, but they were going to send the choppers first thing in the morning. And one of the people that was one of the survivors was a guy called Nate Burkis, who was holidaying in the hotel next to mine. And I was the first person that he saw when he came to higher ground. And he says that when he saw me kind of like commandeering the Jeep radio and making these phone calls, he was like, okay, I'm on her team. I'm leaving her. So I kind of took him under my wing and we became very close over that sort of 24, 48 hours and the ensuing week afterwards as well. And Nate used to be on the Oprah Winfrey show. He used to have the segment on the show where he would redesign people's houses for them.
Oh, yeah. I know Nate Burkis. Yeah, I used to watch his show, actually. Yeah, he had his own show for a while.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So he's kind of famous over here, you know, in the US, not so famous in the UK. So when I was on the phone to the BBC, he was saying to me, tell them that you're with Nate Burkis. And I'm saying, who the hell is Nate Burkis? you know, that was all good. And I told him, but I don't think that the British journalist also knew who Nate Burkis was. But yeah, so, we kind of like really became close over that sort of 48 hours. And Nate actually took the last chopper out with me on the following day. So I got everyone else onto the choppers first and tried to get people on in the order of the severity of their injuries. And then he came on the last chopper with me. And then he actually ended up traveling back to Colombo with with myself and the people that I was with. We ended up spending the night in a guest house. When we did get airlifted, they kind of put us up in a guest house. Nate and I shared a room and kind of like, you know, we're really supporting each other. We've been through this experience. So when we all got back home again a week later, I think we got back on the 1st of January. A few days later, I got a call from him. And it was so great to hear his voice because, you know, when we came home, it was really bizarre because nobody that hasn't been through that experience can understand what it's like to go through it. So it was really nice to hear his voice again, first of all, and to get that connection again. And he just said, look, we're doing a show on Oprah about the tsunami. I'd really love for you to come and to share your story about how you got us airlifted. You know, it was such a remarkable thing that you remembered the number of the BBC switchboard and you got us out of there. And all the money that it's for charity. We're going to be raising money and all the money that we're going to raise is going to go to that village in Aragon Bay. So that was the kind of motivation to go because, you know, I hadn't even left the house when I got back. So I was like, and I didn't have a passport, of course, because my passport had disappeared in the tsunami. So I kind of was like, okay, this is for charity and it's an opportunity to really raise money for that village. And yeah, a few days later, went and got my passport and then I was on a transatlantic flight to Chicago to record the show.
That's great. I mean, so many good things came out of that in the sense, ultimately directly impacting and helping that village, but clearly also having an impact on your life, of course, but still to this day.
Absolutely. So surviving the tsunami was the catalyst for me finding my purpose in life. So when I was interviewed by Oprah, I said to her, I don't know why I was saved when so many others died, because almost 250,000 people died in the tsunami. And of course, I had a lot of survivor guilt, which is quite common when you survive something as big as a tsunami. And But I said to her, we owe it to the people that didn't make it to make the most of our lives and make our lives mean something and count for something. One of the things that had happened while I was in the tsunami was this feeling of dying before I'd actually done anything with my life, dying before I'd left a legacy, before I'd achieved anything that was meaningful. You know, I had career success and all those kind of things, but that wasn't meaningful at that point, you know, when I was dying, when you have that kind of flashing before your eyes. Sort of thing. It was the kind of feeling of, oh my God, I can't believe I'm going to die without having actually achieved anything, falling in love, getting married, having children, none of that I'd done. So it was really, and of course, you know, there were lots of families that lost, you know, members of their family and everything. So I really felt this, and I really do believe that, you know, we come here as spiritual beings and we're here for a particular reason. And that when our soul has come here to do what it's meant to do, that then we move on to the next, you know, to the next dimension or whatever. And I sort of knew that. And I sort of thought, the reason you haven't died is because there's still something that you're here to do. And so we need to find out what that something is that you're supposed to be doing. So yeah, I made a pledge to Oprah on that show that I wanted to make the most of my life and make it count for something, and that we owed it to those that hadn't survived to do that. And that's where the impacting the lives of over a quarter of a million leaders comes from. It's in honor of those same number of people that died in the tsunami, because it felt like to me that for every person's life that I can transform, or I can help to transform in as a human being in this life, it's just honoring that that person that died, and so that they know that they're still being remembered. And that, you know, it feels like I'm making that positive impact in the world on their behalf, kind of thing. Does that make sense?
Sure. Absolutely. I mean, I feel like now I have a lot to aspire to. I think I need to find some more purpose, you know.
Come see me. I can help you.
I'm thinking so. And thankfully, I've got all of your contact information, which is great. One of those ways that you might transform someone's life, I mean, there's obviously large ways and small ways, but one of them is understanding how self-sabotage or saboteurs can affect someone's career, their purpose, their life. Help us kind of understand just overall what that means from a self-sabotage perspective, and then we can dig deeper into that.
Sure. So let me start by telling you about the negativity bias, because that will help your listeners to understand what's going on. So we are all born, I believe, as beautiful, you know, pure spirits and souls, okay? And then what happens in our formative years is that we start to kind of hear the messaging from the outside world, whether it's our parents, teachers, whether it's the news, whatever it is, whether it's the bullies at school or anything. So we start to kind of get these kind of messages through. And what happens in our formative years is that we start to develop these kind of coping mechanisms. They are really defense mechanisms and coping mechanisms to survive life, ultimately. However, we are all born, our brain is kind of pre-programmed for negativity, because we have sort of two main parts of the brain. Then we've got the surviving part of the brain, and we've got the kind of thriving part of the brain. And most of us, well, in fact, everybody has that survival brain function whereby we have that negativity bias, okay? And the reason we have that is because it was much more important for our ancestors to know which was the poisonous snake rather than the pretty butterfly. So that's why our survival brain has kind of like indexes on the negative, one negative thing that's happened in your week. So let's say, for example, you've had a great week, but there's one thing that went wrong in that week. Our brain will naturally just kind of focus on that particular one thing, and it will delete and edit and distort all of the other information to fit in with its story as well. So all of our limiting beliefs are formed in those formative years, okay? and they're formed on based on what our parents tell us. So if your parents turn around and are always saying money doesn't grow on trees, there and you have to work hard to accumulate money, you're going to have a belief in your brain that that's the reality and that you're going to have to work hard to make money, right? Whereas if you have a parent that says, you know, you're crushing it all the time and tells you that you're amazing and you can achieve anything and you can do anything, then that child is going to grow up feeling like they're amazing and that they can achieve anything and do anything. Okay. So where the sabotaging behaviors come in is that we, like I said, we develop all of these traits when we, as coping mechanisms, okay, because ultimately the surviving brain is only occupied with keeping you alive. It doesn't care if you're living your best life. It doesn't care if you're married, if you're having fun, if you're enjoying things, if you've got purpose. It just wants to keep you alive. And of course, it's fear-based messaging, yeah? It's all fear-driven because ultimately our main fear as soon as we're born is that we're going to die because that's just a fact of life. So everything that the survival brain is trying to do is trying to protect you from dying, okay? So it has a function. It's there for purpose. But what happens is that most people end up living their lives based on those fears, and they never really step out of their comfort zone in order to do things that are risky or, you know, like so many people, they won't set up their own business because, you know, they'd rather have a full-time permanent job with a regular income. They may not travel the world because they're worried about the food or getting sick or this kind of thing. So it really limits your ability to live your best life that you can live. So we have a number of different saboteurs, okay? And you can identify these quite easily, you know. So the judge is the master saboteur. And the judge, we can all see the judge quite easily normally because it's the judge of ourselves, that inner critic that tells you that you're not good enough and you should be working harder and, you know, why did you do it like this and all that kind of thing. But then the other ones that we have are the judge of others. Again, that's quite a common one that we can kind of pick up on. Oh, what's she wearing? Or doesn't she look terrible? All that kind of thing. We can see that in our magazines, in our newspapers all the time, right? The judging of others. The other one is a little bit more subtle, which is the judge of circumstances and situations. So, you know, the tsunami and cancer diagnoses and things like that would be usually considered bad situations to happen to someone. You know, if you talk to your parents or your family members about things like that, they're like, oh, that's a terrible thing to happen. However, if you just don't judge the situation as being good or bad, and it just is as is, then you don't attach that good and that bad to it. And you know, from my story, that all of my challenges have actually led me to the path that I'm on. So I can really see the opportunity and the gift in all of the challenges that I've had to face and I've had to overcome. It's led me to finding my purpose. It's all in my brand. My logo is a wave. My mission is about impacting the lives of those 250,000 people. It, you know, it's kind of weaved into everything that I do now in today rather than what I was doing 20 years ago. So once again, you know, it's about not judging those things. So that's the main master saboteur that we all have. Now, before I go on into more of the saboteurs, I just want to highlight that our saboteurs are usually our strengths before we start to overuse them as well.
Tell us more about
interesting.
That.
Yes.
I'm looking forward to hearing about this.
Yes. So what we can, in the positive side, what we have in the judge is what's called sage discernment, okay, or discernment, basically, which is not judging with blame or with anger or with any negative emotion. It is being able to assess a situation objectively without judging, if you sort of mean. So that's the positive side of the judge, for example. But we've got 9 other kind of like main saboteurs, and you will see these in various people, right? So let's say people pleasing behaviors, for example. How many times have you come across somebody that's always doing everything for everyone else? Kind of almost a bit of a martyr to do things for everyone else. But where, and that's a great quality, you know, to be doing things for other people, to help, to be pleasing other people, that kind of thing. But where it becomes a saboteur is when your self-worth becomes wrapped up in pleasing others. And when you're doing it in that martyr type way, and that you're expecting some kind of a return back for it. I want to talk to you about the saboteur, or the archetype, you know, that helped us get out of the tsunami, which was my controller. Now, on the positive side, the controller is able to lead, take charge and command and do all of those kind of things, which is what I was doing in the tsunami. I was able to take charge. I was able to lead. I was able to come up with these ideas of what to do. So that's all strengths, okay? So those are your strengths. However, if I was to overuse my controller, that would look like that I micromanage my team, for example, or I'm trying to bend everyone else to my will all of the time, for example. So that's when it becomes a saboteur behavior rather than the strength. And all of our negative emotions are generated by one of these 10 saboteurs. So if you're in any negative emotion, whatever, apart from grief, which is just, is not a negative emotion, that's an honoring of somebody that's passed. But all of the other negative emotions are wrapped up in one or more of the saboteurs. So I've talked about the pleaser, I've talked about the judge, and I've talked about the controller. We also have the hyperachiever, okay, or the overachiever. So the achiever is, again, a very positive in the sense that it's great to set goals and achievements and things like that. Where it becomes a saboteur behavior is when you are wrapping up your entire self-worth in who, what you do rather than who you are. So it's, you know, it's the person, and this happens a lot in corporate America, for example, because a lot of people attach their, what they do to who they are as a person. The first thing that someone might say to you in America is, what do you do, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Rather than, who are you? Which is, you know, which is quite different. And then, of course, you've got other saboteurs, you've got all sorts of saboteurs. You've got the perfectionist saboteur, for example, when you're trying to create order, ridiculous amount of order, and that, let's say, this is the kind of person that would stay late at work to perfect the presentation and cross all of the T's and dot all of the I's for the presentation, that kind of thing. So there's the perfectionist. Then there's a whole bunch of other ones as well that I could go into if you wanted me to.
Thanks for tuning into the podcast. We hope you're enjoying the episode so far. If you want to stay updated on all the latest content and behind the scenes action, be sure to follow us on social media. You can find us on Instagram, LinkedIn, Facebook, Twitter, and several other places by using the link in the show notes. And if it's not too much trouble, we'd love for you to leave a review and share this episode with some of your friends. Your support means everything to us, and we can't wait to connect with you online. Now, let's get back to the show.
This topic of saboteurs, like how is that used in your coaching practice? Is that where you start the conversation with folks and try to understand what their saboteurs are? Or is this more like kind of a secondary thing that you touch on after really getting into more immediate improvement areas? I just want to know where that fits into the analysis.
Sure. So I what I usually do is I do some assessments with my clients at the beginning. I'll give them a mental fitness test to do. I'll give them a saboteur assessment to do. And that will give a lot of information about how they're currently operating and what are the main saboteurs. And then, you know, we go into having a look at where those patterns and behaviors may have originated from, for example. So, for example, controllers, that people that have become controllers usually have been controlled by a parent a bit too much when they were younger. Maybe they had a strict parent or a very disciplined parent or somebody that really didn't allow them to be free. Yeah. So then you might develop that controlling saboteur when you're an adult, because it's a kind of, it's an antithesis to you being controlled, kind of thing. So controllers don't want to be controlled at all, but they like to be in control. So that's the kind of juxtaposition there. Also, you know, a lot of Asians, for example, they grow up with hyperachievers, sticklers, and sometimes controllers. But women in particular can also have the pleasers, depending on, you know, the kind of environment that they had growing up. It's because a lot of the messaging as an Asian child is get good grades, be the best, do well at school, go to college. It's very much kind of like geared towards those kind of things. So a lot of my Asian clients do have those sort of three, you know, the hyperachiever, the stickler, and the perfectionist, and the sometimes the controller. And if they're a woman and they've had a traditional kind of parenting style for an older generation, let's say, and their mother has been that typical kind of Asian wife or mother, then they kind of also pick up those kind of martyred kind of behaviors of people pleasing and doing everything for everyone else and always putting yourself last and things like that.
I mean, Samir and I being South Asian and having Indian parents, while it comes from a good place, they're by no means were our parents trying to be malicious or to hurt us, but they were looking for this place of safety and they didn't want us to struggle the way they did. And so I know Samir and I, and I can definitely speak for myself, where my focus has always been, you know, go to school, get a good job, buy a home, get married, have kids. And that was success. That was like, you're okay if you do those things. Anything above that was actually negative if you went and tried to take a risk, start your own business. These were all things that were like, whoa, that's a no-no, almost a no-no. So I can relate when you say those things.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I'm also South Asian, right? So I had the same thing growing up. And it is coming from a good place, but it's coming from that survival brain function, okay? It's coming from that place of I need to protect my child as much as possible from all of the harm in the world, okay, because then I've done a good job as a parent. But again, it's very limiting for a person to grow up with that kind of thing, because let's say, for example, you're not an academic person and you're born into an Asian family, but you're a very creative person. You could have been the next Van Gogh, for example, but you're never going to know because you never were able to explore that. So it's important to recognize that messaging that everyone is giving us is all coming from their survival brain function, all coming from fear-based messaging, you know. And like I said, it's there to protect us. It's what stops us from walking out in traffic, but it's not for your highest service. It's not for your best life. So that's why it's important to understand that negativity bias, understand that we have these sort of coping mechanisms that are self-sabotaging behaviors, that as an adult, we don't need to behave in those ways anymore. We can actually work on removing those. So when I work with my clients, for example, I mean, Samir, I think you asked the question, you know, I will go into those. I'll dive into what is the kind of root cause of those different saboteur behaviors that they've got. Let's say a people pleaser, for example, it could have been that they learned that behavior from their parents, from one of their parents. It could be that they have picked up that they need to be the, you know, the kind of unreproachable child in order to get love and affection and attention from parents. So these are the kind of things that we do unconsciously as children. We find the best way that we're going to get the most amount of love, attention, and affection from our parents. If you're an Asian kid, bringing home your A pluses and, you know, being first in the class, you're always going to get that praise. You're always going to get those compliments. So it gives the impression that children are only being loved for conditional reasons, although that's not the case. That's what children will think when we're growing up. Yeah. So then you've also got all the other ones as well. I'm just trying to think of the other ones on the top of my head at the moment. So I've talked about the hyperachiever, the controller, and the perfectionist, and I've also talked about the pleaser. So the victim mindset, for example, victim mindset, you can see is the person that will always blame something or someone else for their behaviors. Or, you know, let's say, for example, you're in a work environment. It's the person when you say to them, oh, where's this project? Oh, I wasn't able to do it because I was waiting for X, Y, or Z to give me this. And they're always, they're never taking responsibility, right? So they're always absolving themselves of responsibility, and they have this more of this martyr sort of streak of, you know, well, why me? You know, so I had a lot of victim mindset earlier in my years, because obviously I survived the tsunami, then I had multiple other near-death experiences, then I had a cancer diagnosis. So I did used to think to myself, why me? Why is all this terrible stuff me? And I have to say, it was my husband that gave me the first reframe on that when I got diagnosed with cancer. And I was like, why me? Why is all this stuff happening to me? And he said, why not you? And it was the first time that I was like, oh, yeah, well, why not me? You know, there's a lot more suffering in the world. And, you know, 80% of the world's population lives on less than $10 a day. Can you believe it? So we're so blessed to be in the 20% of the population that is doing really well. We're probably in the top 10 or 5% of the world. So when I kind of thought of that, I was like, actually, you know, why not me? And, you know, what is the opportunity here for me to grow from and to develop from? And that's where the catalyst, another catalyst for why I do what I do today, because of all of the qualifications I did during that time.
That's interesting. I think with all the saboteurs, like I kind of am able to trace it back. Victim is one. What typically is the root cause for a victim? Because I'm struggling to kind of see the connection.
So the root cause for a victim will be, you know, if they have, you know, they basically, let's say they may have had some struggles as a child. Now, struggles can mean one thing to one person and another thing to another person, okay? But let's say most of our childhoods were quite challenging, I would say, in general. Okay, so, but it's the kind of like person that feels like that they've been hard done by, that, oh, you know, and they attach to the story of something that happened. Maybe one bad thing happened when they were a kid, and then they were like, oh, this, why me kind of thing. So then that becomes the kind of like behavior as an adult. I mean, you know, you have to kind of work with someone on a one-to-one basis to really understand those things. But yeah, that could be one example of where the victim mindset might come from. You know, a lot of people from an older generation were sort of abused, you know, as children, hit or, you know, that kind of thing. So, you know, it was more common for my kind of like generation than it is for the younger generation coming through. But that was just considered normal parenting style back then, and wasn't really sort of questioned at the time. But let's say, for example, you did have that sort of thing going on, and you then were like, you know, you didn't like your parent that was doing that to you, or that you then had this kind of like feeling of like, why me? Why is this happening to me? Then that will kind of create that victim mindset as well.
Really quickly, I got two quick questions for you. And first one can be a yes, no, and then I'm just curious about the second. So first question is, have you ever met anyone without any self-sabotaging traits? And the second is, once you've met someone who and you figured out what their traits are, is just knowing what they are the solution, or is there more steps that you take to help people overcome these traits?
Okay, you might have to say the second question again for me.
Sure. No problem. For you. Let's go with the first one.
Okay, so have I met anybody without any self-sabotaging behaviors? No, and that is the reason for that is because everybody has them. Even the Dalai Lama will have them, okay, because it's part of the survival brain function, okay? Now, but I'm sure that the Dalai Lama has totally slain his saboteurs, mm-hmm. Okay?
Yeah, I bet.
And is not in any saboteurs for any length of time, okay? So it's not a case of that there will be somebody that doesn't have them. It depends on how you've worked on your mental fitness as to whether or not you're saboteurs are running the show or whether you are running the show.
I love that. Okay? Love that.
So yeah. You can work on all of this. You can shift you know, can move out of being in saboteurs, okay, and you can move into a place where you're in your thriving brain and that you can be mentally fit. And in order to be mentally fit, you need to be minimum of 75% of the time feeling content, fulfilled, happy, joyful, peaceful, relaxed, calm, all of those wonderful traits, right?
75%.
Yeah. That's the tipping point because of that 3-to-1 negativity bias. There's the 3-to-1 negativity bias. Okay. We will remember things a negative 3 times more than we will remember a positive. So that's why it's a 75% that we need to be working on our mental fitness. You will always have maybe 5, 10, 15, 20, 25% that will be saboteurs. Okay. And that's okay. It's not a case of, you can't get rid of them completely. Okay. You can't get rid of those fearful thoughts completely. But what you can do is how quickly you can get out of them and how intensely they stay with you. So does that answer that question for you?
It does.
Yeah. It kind of reminds me of anxiety. Like people, they can do the work to get, to get better at handling their anxiety, but it never quite goes away completely, right? So it's like how you get in and out of that anxiety is sort of similar to how you handle your saboteurs.
Yeah, in a way, yeah. But the thing is anxiety is from the saboteurs, okay? And it'll be the unconscious thoughts that are going on in the back of someone's mind, right? So we have like something like 80 to 100,000 thoughts a day or something, the research that I've read recently. So, but most of those thoughts are running in your unconscious, okay? And as Carl Jung says, until you bring the unconscious into the conscious, it will drive your life and you will call it fate. Mm. Because those unconscious thoughts are driving your behaviors in your adult life.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. So you need to create a lot of self-awareness of your internal dialogue and what you're saying to yourself, okay? And by creating that internal dialogue, being aware of that internal dialogue, that's when you are then able to then choose the right thoughts for you that you want to have. So, you know, in the same way that the doctor says we need to be working on our physical well-being 30 minutes a day, moderate exercise, it's exactly the same for your mental and emotional well-being and fitness. We need to work on that 15 to 20 minutes a day in order to be mentally fit and emotionally well. Mental fitness means your ability to overcome life's challenges with a positive rather than a negative mindset. We can't control the external things that happen to us, like a tsunami coming along. You know, we can't control that kind of thing. We can't control all of the things that are going on in the world at the moment. But what we can control is how we respond to them and how we choose to use those experiences. And if you have this, I like to think that life is happening for us, not to us. And I think that reframe really helps, because if you do believe that we're spiritual beings having a human experience, then every challenge that's coming to you is coming to you for the benefit of your spiritual self and for something that you need to learn or grow from. That's my belief, right? So I think that people who have had very challenging lives are blessed in ways because they've had to do a lot of work on the spiritual side of things. Whereas if you have a very easy life with everything handed to you, you're not really doing much work on yourself in life. Yeah. So that's fine. Enjoy your life and do whatever you want. But you know, you still, I just think we're constantly evolving as spiritual beings. And
so what are in your coaching practice, when you're talking about these 15 to 20 minutes, I want to give like a takeaway for our listeners, right? I completely agree with you on the importance of working on self and mental fitness. What are some things that folks can do to start that reframing process?
Absolutely. So look, the main thing is all of our saboteurs, okay, come from not being in the present moment, okay? So if you are anxiety comes from future focus worrying, okay? And depression is kind of like being stuck in the past and not being able to let go of those stories of whatever's gone on in your life, for example. Okay, so let's say you did have a difficult childhood. When the saboteurs are that kind of like, poor me, I always have it really rough, you know, why this has happened to me sort of thing. So, you know, if you stay in the present moment and work on being in the present moment, you won't have saboteurs, okay? So some techniques that, you know, because, you know, I'm going to talk about meditation mindfulness here, but techniques that you can do, because a lot of people get really put off by meditation and mindfulness. So I'm going to call it a completely different thing, which is I'm going to call it mental fitness reps, okay? Mental fitness repetitions that you can do. And you can just do these for 1 or 2 minutes. Okay, regularly throughout the day. So we're not talking about you having to go off and go in a quiet room and all that kind of thing. I work with a lot of busy executives, senior executives. They don't have time to do that. So we integrate these things within the day. So every time, first thing that you need to do is you need to be aware that some negative thought has arrived that has created an emotion within you, right? A negative emotion. And then you need to let that go, because just because you think it, it doesn't make it true. Okay. And then you need to replace it with the opposite positive statement to whatever that negative statement is. And then you need to do like a 1 to 2 minutes of focused attention on one sensation. Okay. So whether that is touch, whether that is sound, whether that is visual, whether that is using the breath or taste, any sensation, and including breath, you can use. And you just focus on that one thing. So I'm going to just give your listeners a tip here. So just rub your finger and your thumb together with such great attention. You can close your eyes for this as well. It's easier to focus in. And you're just rubbing your finger and your thumb together with such great attention and awareness that you notice all the ridges of your fingertips. You're noticing the temperature of your skin. And you're also noticing whether your skin is feeling dry or moist. And then you can also bring all your fingers and your hands together. So you're rubbing both of your hands together very, very slowly. And again, you're doing it with such great attention and awareness that you're noticing the temperature of the skin and all those ridges and bumps, the lines in your hands. And then you can come to open your eyes again.
That really pulls you like to the moment. You have to focus on just everything mm-hmm. that's going on right now.
Exactly.
Mm. Wow.
So so this is a very simple technique. Everybody can do this. You can all find 30 seconds to 2 minutes to do this. You can also do it when you're in a meeting as well. You know, you can do it. When you're, you know, you can, let's say, for example, you've got kids and you're taking your kids to school and you're holding their hands and you're taking them to school. You can do it when you're holding your kid's hand. Really notice the size of their hand, the warmth or the coolness of the hand. You can notice the ridges of their fingertips and their hands. It's just about focusing your attention onto one sensation, whatever that is. If you're in a meeting, for example, you can do a one on somebody's voice, for example. So you're still listening to the content of what they're saying, but you're also listening to the pitch of their voice, the tonality of their voice, the accent. You're listening to the depth of the voice, all of the kind of like the timbre, all of the details of their voice. And again, you've done another 1 or 2 minutes. And every time you do that, because it is meditation and mindfulness that switches our neuroplasticity from surviving to thriving. That's why the Dalai Lama will have slayed his saboteurs, because he is a huge meditator. You know, he's the leader of the Buddhist, of the Tibetan and Buddhist world. So, you know, he will have slayed his saboteurs because he's doing so much of that. But that's how you can do this as, you know, a lay person who's got a full-time job with a family and doesn't have the time to go and sit and meditate for, you know, 15 hours a day for the rest of your life or whatever. So that's how you can do it. And every time you do that, you switch it from your surviving brain into your thriving brain. And you create this shift in your neuroplasticity. If you do these 15, 20 minutes every day, and you did a brain MRI image scan at the beginning of this, and you were then to check your brain MRI imaging at the end of 8 weeks, for example, you would notice that there would be atrophy in parts of the survival brain, and there's new gray matter and new neuropathways in the thriving part of the brain.
Oh, that's fantastic. Ani, I've learned so much in just the short time that we've been together. I'm sure that we could continue on, and I definitely would love to have another conversation. In the last just couple of minutes, how can people find you? Is there anything that's going on that you want to share with our audience? Anything upcoming, any materials or papers or books that are coming out?
Yeah, absolutely. So I do have a book that will be coming out in a couple of months' time. It's going to be called Tsunami, The Wave That Saved My Life. And if people would like to connect with me, my website address is www.ultimateresultsgroup.com, ultimateresultsgroup.com. And you can also find me on all the socials, on Instagram, annie.nakvi. So that's A-N-I dot N for November, A, Q for Quebec, V for Victor, I for India, annie.nakvi on LinkedIn, Facebook, and Instagram as well.
Yeah, we will link to all of that stuff in our show notes, and so everybody can get access to all the great information you have. We look really forward to your book coming out. I'm definitely going to grab myself a copy. I know Ismail and I will be very interested in reading that. And all of your insights today were so amazing. We thank you so much for your time, and we can't wait to chat with you more in the future.
Thank you so much, both of you.
Thanks for tuning in to today's episode of the Emotional Intelligence Podcast. We hope you found it informative and enjoyable. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast on your favorite podcast platform so you never miss an episode. And if you have a moment, we'd really appreciate it if you could leave a review on your favorite platform. Your feedback helps us improve and reach more people. If you're interested in learning more about the topics we discussed today, be sure to check out the show notes for links and resources. You can find them by visiting our website. And if you have any questions or feedback, we'd love to hear from you. You can reach us by email at info@emotionalintelligence.com or connect with us on social media by using the links in the show notes.